that if we can overturn Roe versus Wade, we solve the problem. All right? Many people very mistakenly believe that if we overturn Roe versus Wade, abortion automatically becomes against the law. That is absolutely not true. That is absolutely not true. What Roe versus Wade did was it took the authority to decide whether abortion was going to be permitted or forbidden by law away from the states. And it made a decision that that abortion within certain parameters must be permitted anywhere in the United States. And so what would happen is if Roe versus Wade is reversed, is overturned, the issue will be thrown back to the states. And each state will be able to decide for itself then whether or not it is going to permit abortion. What can we expect to see if Roe versus Wade is overturned? We would see battles going on in virtually every state throughout the Union. And then what we would see is a patchwork quilt of states that allow abortion and that forbid abortion. Those that allow abortion under virtually any circumstances, those that allow abortion under more restricted circumstances, and those that are that forbid abortion under almost all conditions. But chances are, if you live in a state which forbids abortion, outlaws abortion, you probably will not have to travel very far to get one. All right. For instance, here in Northern Kentucky right now, I don't think there's any place in Northern Kentucky that is performing abortions. All right. I don't think that anybody is doing therapeutic abortions in the states. But all you, or in Kentucky, all you have to do is go to Cincinnati. Go to Planned Parenthood in Cincinnati, and you're able to get that. That situation will continue. Also, what we have to understand is that more and more abortions are not taking place in clinics and hospitals. They're taking place at home through medical or through pharmacological abortion with the morning after pill and the abortion pill and there's other medications also on that handout. There's some information there about a number of techniques that are being used to do this, all right? And including what we have to acknowledge is that some things that are being used very commonly by Catholics for birth control, the pill, all right, can cause abortions, all right? Because it does not necessarily, usually my understanding is the vast majority of times the pill actually prevents conception. But sometimes what it does is it allows conception, but what it prevents is the implantation of the fertilized ovum, or the embryo, into the lining of the uterus of the mother, which causes the baby to be aborted. This is also true for what is the Norplant, all right? Which according to this, that acts for 5 years. In the first couple of years, 2 to 3 years, as it is a stronger supply of the chemical that's going into the body, it tends to operate more contraceptively. But then, in the last 2 years of that, where you're probably getting less and less of a dose, what it's actually doing is not preventing conception, but it's preventing implantation and is causing abortions. It's causing abortions, all right? Invisible abortions. Abortions that the woman didn't even actively seek out because she never knew that she was pregnant, but she was doing something that was causing this abortion. Changing the law. Oh, and then, you know, so if we overturn Roe versus Wade, those medications will still find their way. All right? I believe that if we were to overturn Roe versus Wade and make abortion illegal today in every state in the United States, tomorrow a huge underground abortion industry would spring up. All right? And people would know how to get an abortion very easily. How difficult is it for a teenager to get alcohol? How difficult is it to get marijuana? All right? They're both illegal. It's illegal, right? It's illegal for teenagers to be able to get alcohol. It's illegal for anybody to be able to get pot or cocaine or whatever. It's not a trick. It's not for anybody who is going to want to know, how do I get these drugs, how do I get these procedures, will be able to get it. This is the truth. Now, I still believe in overturning these because I think as long as it's in law, As the last point, or one of the last points that's in the chapter, talks about scandal, is leading people astray. Kids who are growing up in a culture that says abortion is legal interpret that as, well, then it must be okay. Because if it wasn't okay, if it was wrong, they would make it illegal, right? But the reality is we have to know this battle will not be won by overturning Roe versus Wade. That is just a beginning. We will have to win hearts and minds one at a time. That is where the real victory over abortion, if it's going to be won, is going to take place. So, let's go on. There's a need for a legal, cultural, and spiritual change of hearts. In vitro fertilization. Why is this being treated here? The book acknowledges that this is better treated under the Sixth Commandment, which deals with sexuality and the union that has to exist, the unity between marital love and conception. But it is treated here as well because most in vitro fertilization also includes the destruction of fertilized embryos. Because what normally happens is that when they do in vitro fertilization is that there are a number of eggs that are fertilized. And then as they see which ones of these are progressing and strongest, those are then implanted into the womb of the mother. And the others are destroyed. Either that or they're frozen and stuck somewhere. And so then there are a lot of those. There are a lot of those. I've talked to Catholic women who say, you know, we made this decision. We have these. And what do we do now? Well, you've created a pickle. You've created a real pickle because you now have these frozen embryos, and you're pretty much stuck. You know, I mean, you've done something that is irreversible. You can't fix this. You can't fix this.
So, is the vitro then still considered wrong if all of those eggs are used?
No. In vitro fertilization is considered wrong by the church, firstly, because of the break between the marital act of love, all right, and conception, all right, because there has been a rupture of that. It is secondarily opposed because in most cases you're also dealing with the destruction of embryos, all right. So that's why it's treated here. It will be treated again when we get into the Sixth Commandment, okay? What's that? If a woman cannot get pregnant outside of in vitro fertilization, it is still wrong, yes. Because it is you're rupturing the relationship between the sexual act and the act of marital love and of conception. And because of this, because it usually involves the destruction of embryos. So yes, it is always wrong. It is always wrong. All right? Stem cell research and cloning. What does the Catholic Church believe about stem cell research? We are all for it. We are absolutely in favor of stem cell research. And that is a great misperception, not only out there, but also within the Catholic community as well. There are two different kinds of stem cells. And we have to make this distinction if we're going to understand the issues involved. There are those that are called embryonic stem cells. And these are, the only way to get them is to produce an embryo, which is a human being, and then to destroy that human being to take the stem cells. And then there are what are called adult stem cells, all right, which are actually what they are is they're more developed. They can come out of an umbilical cord. They don't have to come out of an adult, all right? That's the way they can come out of an umbilical cord and others. Now, what is a stem cell? A stem cell is essentially an undifferentiated cell. It is a cell that has the potential to become any number of things, all right? So again, if you go back to the embryo, all right, and the cells, the stem cells in the embryo have the capacity to become arms and fingers and legs and brains and neurosystems and all the things, but they haven't differentiated yet, all right? Something will happen that will cause some of them to develop into arms and bones and et cetera, and others that will turn into skin, and others that will turn into the nervous system. But at this point, they are undifferentiated. And so, again, just staying with the embryonic stem cells, what the hope is that they are going to be, if they take those, and if they can learn how to direct the differentiation, that they can treat genetic problems, all right, such as Huntington's disease, Parkinson's disease, that they will be able to do something to those embryonic stem cells, maybe even and cure those problems. That sounds like a good reason we want to be able to do this, all right? And that's what they say. You don't care about Parkinson's disease. You don't care about Huntington's disease. Well, let's talk about some facts here. The Catholic Church encourages adult stem cell research. We encourage that, we support that, and we know that there have been dramatic breakthroughs that have happened from that research. We know that there have been dramatic therapeutic breakthroughs that have happened from research on adult stem cells. All right. There has, as of now, even though they're doing them, the church opposes embryonic stem cell research because it requires the killing of an embryo of a human being. It is the harvesting of stem cells from a human being, but necessarily killing the human being to do that. There has not yet been any therapeutic results that have come from any of that. Those stem cells seem at this point in research to be so fragile and so, I'm not sure what the word is, but just that they have had no success whatsoever. Any idea that they have that we're going to be able to cure Parkinson's and Huntington's from these embryonic stem cells is just pure speculation. There's no evidence of that at this point, that they are going to be able to cure anything with those, all right? I think the word I was looking for is they are so unstable. They're so unstable at that point. Whereas there is great results already and great promise from adult stem cell research. So, where do we stand? We are all about stem cell research. But we are completely opposed to embryonic stem cell research because it is about the killing of a child. But what if I have a kid who is 18 years old, who has Huntington's disease, and it's kicking in, and I know that over the next few years there's going to be a complete deterioration. And what if, through embryonic stem cell research, we could, in fact, develop some kind of a procedure that would save my child's life? Would it be morally acceptable to do that? No, because I can't kill this kid to save this kid, all right? It's that simple, all right? You can't kill one kid to save another kid. You don't get to kill one innocent. You can never, ever, 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 under any circumstances, intentionally destroy the life of an innocent human being. Ever, all right? No matter how good your intentions are, you can never do that. And it's that simple. So the church says absolutely no on that basis. Cloning. What is cloning? Cloning is the creation of human beings. Are there not enough of us? Is there something going wrong with the traditional way of making human beings that we need to come up with another way of doing it? All right, we seem to be pretty efficient, all right, and at this. So I don't see what it is about our need to create human beings. It's not like we have lost the capacity to reproduce, and this is the only way the human race is going to survive. Why do we want to do it? Because we can. Right? Because we can, because of scientific curiosity. But what it does is it turns human beings into science experiments. Right? It turns human beings into science experiments. That's what they want to do, is they want to see if they can, and they are. And human beings are created in the image and the likeness of God, are children of God. They are not science experiments. Human beings do not exist in Germany. What was it, Dr. Mendela, was that his name, or something like that, who was who was doing all of the studies and was using, you know, people who had different handicaps or whatever and difficulties, and he was experimenting. We don't get to do that. We don't get to do that. Here in our own country, we've done it.
We did it. They experimented on prisoners, all right, by infecting them with syphilis on purpose, all right, back blacks prisoners back in like in the early part of the 20th century, in order to try to see what can we learn about this so that we can try to find some cure. You don't get to do that. Even the prisoners, you don't get to treat them as experiments. That's what cloning does. You cannot do that. It is absolutely morally unacceptable. Euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, of course we say, no, you cannot do that. Death penalty, all right? Now, there's a quote on 394. You're going to have to go back. If you have not read this chapter, you're going to need to go back because there's too many issues for me to go into depth on each one. Is the death penalty ever permitted under Catholic moral teaching? Yes. Under the moral teaching about self-defense, that if the only way in which society can protect itself from this criminal is to execute them, then it is morally permissible to execute them. All right? But if there is any other way, then no. Now, this is a quote from the Catechism. If, however, non-lethal means are sufficient to defend and protect people's safety from the aggressor, authority, that's the state, the nation, will limit itself to such means, to non-lethal means, as these are more in keeping with the concrete conditions of the common good and more in conformity with the dignity of the human person. Today, in fact, as a consequence of the possibilities which the state has for effectively preventing crime, by rendering one who has committed an offense incapable of doing harm, by locking them up, right, in a way that they are no longer capable of doing harm, without definitively taking away from him the possibility of redeeming himself. See, this is one of the concerns of the church, is that when you execute someone, you take away from them the capacity, the future, right, of conversion. And it is God's desire that all be converted. And it is the church's desire that all be converted. And so when you strip them of that, then you are really attacking God's will for that person. And the only way in which you can do that is if there is no other way to protect society from them. All right? The cases in which the execution of the offender is an absolute necessity, there's some quotes here, quotation marks, these are from Pope John Paul II's encyclical on the Gospel of Life, are very rare, if not practically non-existent. Now, I know that this is an issue that many Catholics really wrestle with. Many Catholics really have a problem with. And I understand that. But there's just some stuff that's in the paper this week where states are finding that they just can't afford to fight these battles. You know, it costs millions of dollars to go through not only imprisoning and then finally executing, but going through all the legal trials and everything that's necessary in order before you can do that, it's cost prohibitive, for one thing. It does not in any way, there's no evidence whatsoever that it has any impact on reducing crime. All right, so there is no good purpose for it. There may be an extraordinary circumstance where there would, but generally there is not. War. Pope John Paul the 23rd, in his encyclical Pacem in Terris, Peace on Earth, wrote that peace is a gift from God. It is not something that we as human beings will ever be able to achieve on our own. But the best way for us to seek to stop war is to safeguard peace, to work for peace. It lists three different things that we need to do. First of all, letting go of anger and hatred. There are the ancient hatreds and angers that exist between nations that lead to wars, and there needs to be a letting go of that. But that begins with me. Can I expect the Sunnis and the Shia to forgive hundreds and hundreds of years of hostility and hurts and against one another if I'm not willing to forgive you? Doesn't it begin right here? All right? It begins with each one of us. We have to begin that and then show the world the way. Secondly, eliminating poverty, injustice, and the deprivation of human rights, which is often what leads to war. All right? Where you have a country that is oppressing its people or another people, and that people is rising up to try to achieve freedom and justice, and so there is violence as they try to overthrow the oppressor, and the oppressor is using violence to continue to oppress the oppressed. All right? So there needs to be elimination of that. Disarmament is also an important issue. Now, just war, this is an important topic, and it's on page 396. I'm going to run through this very quickly. There's a quote there from the Catechism on 396. The strict conditions for legitimate defense by military force require rigorous consideration. The gravity of such a decision makes it subject to rigorous standards of moral legitimacy at one and the same time. So we're going to see there are these conditions. They all have to be present at the same time. All right, that's what this means. At one and the same time. So you can't say, well, we've got three of these conditions, therefore there's a preponderance of conditions. We get to do it. The church says all of these must be present if we are going to call this a just war. The damage inflicted by the aggressor on the nation or community of nations must be lasting, grave, and certain. So any just war has to be, first of all, a war of self-defense. Another nation must have done something, have caused some kind of harm to our nation or to the world, all right, to the world, the community of nations, that is not minor, but is lasting, grave, and certain. All other means of putting an end to it must have been shown to be impractical or ineffective. War must be the last resource, not the first. All right? We must have exhausted every other means before we do that. There must be serious prospects of success. If we do not think, if there's no way that this war is going to be successful, don't start it. You do not have a moral right to start a war knowing that you are going to, that the chances are you're going to fail. The use of arms, all right, this is very important. The use of arms must not produce evils greater than the evil to be eliminated. So, if we're going to war to stop a nation that is doing something that is harmful, we have to, it can only be if the war that we are going to start is not going to end up causing more harm than the harm that we're trying to stop. The power of modern means of destruction weighs very heavily in evaluating this condition, especially because they move to bigger and bigger weapons, all the way up to nuclear weapons. These are the just elements enumerated in what is called the just war theory. The evaluation of these conditions for moral legitimacy belongs to the prudential judgment of those who have the responsibility for the common good. That would really mean the state has the responsibility of making this decision. But the church does have a moral responsibility to critique those decisions and to say, you know what, the conditions are not here, all right? And rarely have the conditions ever actually been present. Every nation that has ever waged war against another nation has felt morally justified in doing so. But rarely have they actually, if you apply the moral teaching of the church, rarely has a war ever been morally justified. On page 397, under no circumstances may nuclear weapons or other instruments of mass slaughter be used for the purpose of destroying population centers or other predominantly civilian targets. You cannot drop nuclear weapons on cities. All right, you cannot, and that includes carpet bombing as well. You know, just blanket bombing of cities. You cannot, when you do war, you cannot do that. All right, if you have, there may be times when sometimes a nation will hide its military force within the community, within the larger community, and you may have to go in a just war to try to attack that, and there will be civilians who will be killed. But you cannot simply go in and say we're going to destroy this city in order to affect the outcome of this war. That is never, ever morally, because you are intentionally at that point killing innocent human beings. Terrorism, obviously, cannot be ever accepted. Scandal, what is this? Scandal is leading the weak and ignorant into sin. Words and examples of Christians who do not stand up for life or who distort it. This would be the sin of Catholic politicians, or one of the sins of Catholic politicians, who support abortion. Not only are they doing something wrong by supporting abortion, but as Catholic politicians, as prominent Catholics, they are leading people astray. And they are giving people who are of weak conscience, and that's what the sin of scandal is about, of giving people who do not have an adequate education and training in the faith, it is giving people the impression that it is okay to be a Catholic and be in favor of abortion. All right? So they are leading people into sin through that scandal. It is grave scandal, and it is a serious problem, as we all know. There are a number of points that are on the last part that deals with the right of the dying to live. You know, there's a big movement in our country called the right to die. But there is also the right of the dying to live, right? The right of the dying to live with dignity, to be treated with dignity, to be taken care of with dignity and with love. Now, I do not think that that means that we have to go to extraordinary measures in order to keep people alive beyond when they necessarily even want to. You know, I'm not one that wants to live forever. I really do not. I hope I'm not here when I'm 100. I really do not want to live that long. I believe in heaven. I believe in Jesus, and I'm looking forward to seeing him, all right? And so, you know, I do not have a burning desire to just live and live and live and live. It is okay to die. Do you know it's okay to die? Isn't that pretty central to our faith that it's okay to die? That dying is not a disaster? That dying is a moving into the next stage of life, all right? Yeah, yes, and you know, a lot of times with funerals, I use the image of birth. You know, the baby is in the mother's womb. Well, you know, the baby doesn't want to come out of the womb before it's ready, right? It doesn't want to come out of the womb before it's ready. It doesn't want to be popping out there at 3 months, all right? But is it good that baby is going to be born? Absolutely. And yeah, if we're young, and especially if we're young parents, and we have kids, and we have people we're responsible for, you know, we're really kind of holding on to this life because we've got responsibilities and duties and we've got work to do and we don't want to die, all right? But if we do, it's okay because there's another stage of life. This is only part of the deal. And so it is okay for us to move on to the next life. But we don't want to rush people, all right? We don't want to give people the idea that you are a burden and we need to get rid of you, all right? You need to move on, all right? So that we'll be all be better off once you are gone. No, we can't do that. So I think it's important to read all that's there. There's some very important things that are there. Just want to throw in just a couple of moments for questions. All right. Again, this is not stuff that anybody's surprised. I don't think anybody's too surprised to hear what I've got to say tonight. This is pretty basic Catholic teaching on the culture of death and the gospel of life.
Just a quick kind of plug, I guess. There's a new movie coming out. They're trying to come out. I suggest everybody go look it up and actually sign up for it. It's called Blood Money. And it shows how a lot of the abortion industry itself is actually going after money. A lot of things they try to promote, like try to have girls having abortions by the time they're 15, all these kind of different things. It's a good movie, and I suggest everybody trying to get out there and plug it.
He's talking about it's a movie which is coming out. I don't know. It sounds like it won't make it into theaters. It'll probably be straight to video. But it's called Blood Money, and it is sounds like a documentary concerning the abortion industry and how it is driven, as all industries are, by profit. And driven by profit, it is encouraging women and especially even young girls. They're trying to get it into theaters through petitions, but chances are it's going to be easiest to see it when it comes out on video because it's going to be, it'll show up in a theater for 1 week and it'll be gone, all right, because of the kind of audience that it's going to have. So it's called Blood Money, and look at that. Anything else? Okay, if most wars are not just, and you are serving in the military, again, it is the judgment, the people who have the moral responsibility, according to the church's teaching, to make this judgment, because they have more of the facts than the private citizen and the individual soldier do, is the government, all right? And so they are the ones that bear the moral responsibility for making this decision. Now, if I know that I'm involved in a just war, all right, then I am morally justified in saying I will not participate in this. All right? This is what conscientious objection is about on the part of those who refuse to enter into the military, as well as those who are part of the military but who are perhaps put into a military situation that they become morally convinced is immoral. We have a moral responsibility. If we are convinced that we are being told to do something that is immoral, we have a responsibility not to do it. We have a moral responsibility. And then to bear whatever the consequences are for that. And those consequences may be great. You know, there have been people who've gone to jail, gone to prison because of their conscientious objection. And so sometimes standing up and doing the right thing has a great cost attached to that. But we are always, it's like, okay, what does the government know that we don't know? And sometimes when these decisions are being made, and so it becomes, there is a presumption, all right, in most cases that the government is trying to make the right decision, all right? Now, obviously, you can be Germany, World War II is kind of the model that we always go to. And certainly at the Nuremberg trials, claiming that we were following orders was said, that is not a defense. All right? You cannot use we were following orders as a defense for having done criminal acts. All right? I've never been in the military, but my understanding is that they were at least taught, and I don't know how much this is emphasized, that you have a right to refuse, some of your military people can tell me that, to refuse what you know to be a criminal order. Is that right? All right. Now, I don't know how much that's stressed, all right? You're dealing with young kids who are still very embryonic in their own moral development at that point, and so are being put in situations where they're probably not going to be able to have the kind of inner spiritual resources that are going to be necessary. But if you know, I mean, I read something this past year about Lieutenant Calley. Any of you remember Lieutenant Calley, the My Lai incident back in the Vietnam War, and that he was speaking somewhere, and he said what I did was terrible, and he said I live with it every day, and that he has recognized it, you know, and I do believe that he was scapegoated in that situation, that there were upper people who got off who actually had ordered him to do what he was ordered to do, and then he ordered his men to slaughter these villagers, all right? Now, if you know that your commanding officer is ordering you to slaughter innocent people in this village who are non-combatants, you have a moral responsibility to say, no, I'm not going to do that, all right? And it may be, there may be serious consequences, court-martial, whatever else it may come, but that's the price of being faithful, all right? So, sometimes being faithful, there it is. There's the price of being faithful. Okay, we will meet on December 2nd, and we will be on the Sixth Commandment. I think the Sixth and Ninth Commandments. Okay, so let's stand. We'll close the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. See you in a few weeks. Thank you.